Hello, and thank you for downloading Wax Lyrical. Before we get into the latest episode, we've got a little gift for you. Today, we're going to be hearing from the team behind no alcohol beer Lucky Saint, and they've kindly provided all Wax Lyrical listeners with a discount code. Just go to their site, luckysaint.co, and use the code WAX10 to get £10 off your first case of 12 or more. Remember, go to luckysaint.co and use code WAX10. Enjoy, and here's the episode. Hello and thank you for downloading Wax Lyrical, the Scale Up and Change Up Marketing podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society, and I'm Mark Runicus.
Hi, and I'm Paul Jacobs, and today's podcast guests are Luke Bowes and Emma Hill, respectively, the founder and managing director of alcohol-free beer Lucky Saint. That's right, listeners, today's pod is about beer, which in my opinion is a very good start. Welcome to Wax Lyrical, Emma, Luke. Thank you so much for joining us. We're really looking forward to today's chat.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
Let's start as we mean to go on and dive straight into your beer. I guess in an ideal world, we'd be in a pub, celebrate soon, hopefully fingers crossed, as we emerge from lockdown. So Emma, I'll come to you first. Imagine we are sitting in a pub and you very kindly bought us a round of Lucky Saint. What am I drinking? What's it like?
Oh, I'd love to be doing that right now. Hopefully we're nearly there. Right, what I would do is I would pour you blind taste test a bunch of beers, including Lucky Saint and a bunch of others. And what will happen if we put Lucky Saint last is you'll taste through a couple. And what normally happens, we find with consumers, they'll say, there's just something not quite right about that beer. You know, it tastes quite thin. Or, you know, if you knew what was in it, it's got thickeners in, like lactose, which is milk, or this strange powder called maltodextrin, which is a chemical compound. And then you'll get to Lucky Saint and you'll be like, they'll just look at it and see it's got body. This is what happened to me when Luke sent me a box blue. It's got a head on it and the taste is a classic, fresh, refreshing pilsner. And it will be like nothing that you've tried before.
Sold. I'd be halfway down it after that description, I think. Well, hopefully we can do that soon in the pub. And before you go any further, Luke, I have to ask, kind of, what does the name Lucky Saint mean?
I think so. The name Lucky Saint was actually the hardest thing I think we did. I remember we got through all the way through, pretty much all the way through the design process, and still actually hadn't finalised what a name was. Things kept coming up, and then they'd be trademarked and. We'd always had this idea of calling it Saint, but it never quite worked and it was trademarked. And then we went all the way around the houses and looked at like lots of other things. And then we were joining adjectives to other names. I was talking on the phone to Jono, who runs Other Way, who was doing all of the brand design and kind of development work. And he said, what about Lucky Saint? And it was literally like, it was that moment where you thought, okay, well, I think we've done it. And after literally 2 months and the final 2 weeks of those 2 months, I'd done nothing other than look at names. And I guess the meaning of it for me was the saint has this wonderful, like kind of nod to virtuosity in it. And then I have always been obsessed by this podcast series called How I Built This. Yeah. And the last question that Guy Raz always asks is how much of your success do you put down to skill and judgment and how much do you put down to luck? And they're always very modest, right place, right time, lucky breaks, met the right person, all these things. So the lucky part of Lucky Saint is a nod to the luck that we all need to make things work.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a quote about luck, isn't there? The harder I practice, the luckier I get.
Okay.
Lee Trevino, I think, is that right? I'm showing my age.
It's usually a golf reference, yeah.
Yeah. But okay, the planner in me is fascinated by the fact that actually the low alcohol is really recessive in the branding. And I can see strategically why you've done that. So first and foremost, as Emma has very eloquently explained, it's a great tasting pilsner, but it is a low alcohol beer nonetheless. So what is the secret to making it great tasting and low alcohol? How have you managed to do that?
So you're right, like, we don't say alcohol free on the bottle. Never wanted that to be the thing that came out first and foremost. But the way we have kind of achieved the product and we got to something that we think is different and better is actually by going all the way back to the beginning and applying the very best brewing principles. So for natural ingredients that you're supposed to find in a lager, nothing else, there's no flavorings, there's no additives. It's 100% Pilsner malt. It's Hallertau hops, which are locally grown at the brewery. It's Bavarian spring water, which lends itself really, really well to brewing lagers specifically because it's soft and has the right mineral content in it. And funnily enough, actually, the master brewer goes to the water source every single morning and drinks it fresh from the water source before he brews with it. This is the obsessive nature of the world we live in. Focus on ingredients, and then it takes 6 weeks to brew it. So modern beer is brewed in as little as 3 days or less, but Lucky Saint takes 6 weeks to brew. So it's 2 weeks of fermentation and then 4 weeks of lagering, and lagering means to cold store. And this is where all of the magic happens and all of the flavors like mature and balance out in exactly the same way that the original Pilsner was brewed back in 1842. So kind of very much sort of heritage approach and authentic approach to brewing. And then we've got this modern twist on it because right at the end, we after 6 weeks, we then pass it through a thing called vacuum distillation and remove the alcohol from it. The final thing that made, I think, the biggest development during development was we were brewing filtered beer, and the filtration process in brewing that's used everywhere gives you a clear, bright beer, but it also strips out flavor and body, and those are two things that are inherently lacking within alcohol-free beer. So we switched and changed the process a little bit and started leaving it unfiltered, and I remember the day first tasting our first unfiltered beer and night, it just retained so much more flavor and character in it.
And who's drinking it, and more importantly, as in who's drinking low alcohol beers these days, but more importantly, who's drinking Lucky Saint?
So who's drinking Lucky Saint? We see a really, really wide number of people moderating. This isn't about just about people who don't drink or are sober or teetotal. We're seeing all age demographics are now moderating. And specifically, it's on occasions where they're replacing, generally speaking, an alcoholic beer. So they're looking to replace, and that the first place that you start moderating generally is like Monday to Thursday at home. But as the category grows, really interestingly, we're beginning to see, and this has happened loads over the last 12 months because people have learnt, moderated at home during COVID and lockdown. And then those trends are now creeping later and later into the week into more and more on-trade occasions as well.
I'll be honest, I'm fascinated by the growth of the low and no alcohol category. And it, honestly, it surprised me. So, Emma, where has this come from? But as excitingly, where is it going?
Yeah, there's been a huge step change over the last few years. The development of liquids that have, you know, that are rooted in quality and therefore have a good taste, that's where it's all really happening, because the number one reason for people to go into no and low is the taste. But I think we talked about this. This isn't about abstention. This is about moderation. So the really interesting part is most alcohol-free consumers drink alcohol too. 58% of no and low consumers switch between no and low and full strength alcohol options on the same occasion. So you might kick off with a couple of alcohol-free beers and then hit the wine, or you've had one cocktail and then you revert back to the alcohol-free beer. And consumers who drink alcohol are twice as likely to drink no and low, actually, versus those that don't drink at all. So this is a really broad church, and there's 30 million drinkers in the UK, and 8 out of 10 people are actively choosing to moderate their lifestyle. COVID has actually exacerbated that. So, yeah, while taste is really important, actually, you know, the fact that people are getting healthier, are trying to look after themselves in all sorts of areas, moving to alcohol-free option is definitely a bigger part of it. But definitely taste doesn't tell the whole story. It's also about social occasions. So, you know, you say, well, let's meet up for a drink. It's just implied you're going to have an alcoholic drink. That's changing now. And people, you know, socialising isn't about alcohol. It's becoming much easier to socialise without booze. And we say, you know, moderation isn't the dirty word it once was. So where's it going? We think it's going to come like a steam train. So if you think about the plant-based movement that's happened over the last few years, to put where we are in context, the UK market is about 1.5% alcohol-free beer. Compare that to 6 or 7% in Germany. Compare that to 15% in Spain. We are behind the curve and it's coming. And if you think about all the big brewers, global brewers like Heineken, ABI, Asahi, they've set global targets. So by 2025, thereabouts, they want 20 to 25% of their whole portfolio to be alcohol free. So there is demand and there's an incentive from the brewers to do it as well. So yeah, it's gonna be big.
So Luke, we've talked about distribution, and this, I'm sure this is no mean feat, but you're the first alcohol-free brand available on draft outside of London. So tell us kind of, how have you chosen geographically where to target?
We are based in London. We've started in London. The consumer, the non-alc consumer, is most advanced in London and the South East. So we launched draft in January 2020. And funny enough, there was loads of debate around whether we should do it and whether it would work and would anyone want it? Would anyone drink it in the depths of January and winter? And actually, we decided, like, in true Lucky Saint style, in about November, that we should definitely do it. And so we scrapped it all together, and in the end, we bought what we thought was 3 months stock, and we sold it in 3 weeks, and it absolutely flew. Last year, in the bits of the year that were trading in the on-trade, we began to move more national, and then since lockdown's eased this time around, we've now got national distribution. I think it's probably less around geography and more around choosing the right types of venues where it's going to work, where the consumer is in the right mindset. But if we're having a meeting just before this, I'm talking about, rather than having target consumers and thinking about them in terms of what their demographic is, thinking about it in terms of what their mindset is, what types of characters are interested in that, and actually that ends up being a way broader audience than just taking a specific demographic. We have this kind of amazing spread of everything from Michelin style, which is obviously packaged beer rather than draft. You know, we love all of those things. It gives you such good credibility to go and kind of talk to the next person about, really. and that is it's a very kind of well-trodden model within drinks, is that you start at kind of the top of the triangle with the most influential venues that perhaps don't do the highest volume, but they are. And we just keep on feeding the top of the triangle because it's such an important and influential part. And then you can, at the same time, you can then go and do much, you can sell in much broader range of venues at the same time.
And same with you, Luke, you've talked about the quality and the experience, which is obviously much more controllable in D2C. Now you're kind of going more and more into on-trade, and kind of how are you maintaining that Lucky Saint experience when it's kind of slightly outside of your control?
Well, actually, we start at the very top. I think, like, in everything that we do, we have three values and four mantras. And so we always try and live by those. So our values are to be generous, stay humble, and get lucky. And then our mantras are to find the devil in detail, to do the right thing well, to break rules, honor traditions, and to make sustainability second nature. As we think about, to your point about how do we then go and kind of apply and maintain standards across channels when we start to lose a bit of that control, for the on-trade, for example, if we apply like finding the devil in the detail, we want to make sure that every activation that we do has something uniquely Lucky Saint about it. It is about like making sure that the glassware that we put in there, you know, has the Ladybird mark on it. Or finding just really nice ways. For example, when we launched Draft, we did a collaboration with a business called Made for Drink, and we developed a bespoke bar snack to pair perfectly with the beer. And everyone who ordered a pint of Lucky Saint then got some salted almonds and candied orange served with it. So it was just this completely unscalable, logistical nightmare, but kind of totally brilliant thing to do. And then you have to make sure, you know, the team all believe in what you're doing in the same way that, like, you know, so our values and mantras will run all the way through the team, from Emma and I, through the sales team, the marketing team, so that the sales execs who are out on feet on the streets and in contact with the bars and pubs on the ground are living by the same set of standards that we all, you know, we want to uphold for the whole brand.
Now, we've met you both a couple of times, and audio we are, but we actually record this using Zoom, so I can actually see you. You're both together. And I hope you don't mind me saying this, you kind of riff off each other. So there's clearly, to me, a great working relationship. But starting with you, Luke, when and how did you decide that you needed to bring on board somebody like Emma?
Funny enough, I met our now chairman about 3 months after we launched, and he very quickly, we started having a conversation around kind of building team, because at that point there were three people in the business. So there was me, there was a grab, and there was a salesperson. The thing that he talked to me about was just, if you bring in disproportionately senior talent people at a disproportionately early stage, but the kind of the trigger for that is, I guess, having the confidence that you've got product market fit, for want of a sort of technology phrase. But, you know, we had a liquid that people said was delicious, and we had a brand that was resonating with people. So remember when we launched and like Honest Burgers was our first customer. It was my first ever sales meeting, and I sat outside their original restaurant with Tom, the founder, in Brixton. And he loved the beer, and he said he'd put it in all 28 of his restaurants. So that was our start point. But we just, in our first month, we won 100 on-trade listings, and in our second, we won another 100, and then another 100. And I felt like confident that we had something that was working. So the next step, you know, that Shalane and I talked about was, well, you know, to really kind of go for it and try and hire that, make that kind of much more senior hire at an early stage. Because I didn't come from drinks or FMCG, or frankly have any experience at any of this. I guess that was the trigger for kicking the search off.
And for you, Emma, of course, as Mark said, just sat next to each other, so hopefully you can answer as honestly as possible. But how's it been for you coming in and working so closely with Luke, the founder?
Yeah, it's funny. I was also talking to Shalane. I'd just got on mat leave, so second one. And I'd left my previous role as managing director of Grey's, the retail part. And we had a great chat. And he said, look, I need you. He was looking after, you know, alcohol-free products for Distill Ventures, which is the VC part of Diageo. He said, I need you in one of my businesses. And introduced me to a few founders. He said, I don't care which one you go in. You'll just know when you meet the founder, 1 out of 1 equals 15. And that is still a hair-raising moment for me when he said that. And I've met loads. And I met Luke, and I think just clicked really well. And I could see how I could add value to the business. But we have very, very complementary skill sets. And I think we're very respectful of each other's skill sets. Obviously, Luke's super bright. He has an incredibly high bar and level of attention to detail on the brand, on the liquid, but also very humble. Very ambitious, which I loved. I think the way I describe it is Luke's the compass and I'm the map. So my role is really to extract the magic from Luke's head and make it replicable. And then obviously ensuring our values go across everything we do, building the team. And yes, there's the process word and all that stuff. But I basically, I'm building a machine to go faster and bigger, quicker, because as Luke said, we had a proven concept and we knew we had a product that worked. So really it's just about the hustle.
There's an interesting moment because it actually then, I don't know, we started the, I guess, thinking about this role at the beginning of 2019, and then Emma and I met in the summer of 29, and then I think we got everything kind of agreed, but there's definitely there was a sort of daunting moment because it, like, bringing in someone with so much experience and you've got so much respect for them, and then you have this kind of terrifying moment where you have to pull back the curtain and reveal what's going on behind the scenes. It's been fantastic, and there was definitely no judgment from Emma. particularly as a solo founder, and you've just, you know, been making it work as best you can, and then you kind of like pull it back and you go, I wonder what's going to happen next.
So here on the podcast, we've had quite a number of female leaders in the drinks category, and they have all said, rather disappointingly, how macho, how male-dominated it is, with all of the baggage that that brings with it. So Emma, I got to ask, how are you finding it?
Yeah, I don't know if it's because I, you know, came into the category and 6 weeks later we went into lockdown, so everything's been done on Zoom rather than sort of boozy evenings. But I haven't seen that, and I have been so inspired. There are so many amazing female leaders out there in FMCG and hospitality. And if anyone's listening to this, I've just got a few I have to talk through because they have been, for me, absolutely amazing and giving me loads of tips and loads of confidence to go out there. For example, Emma McClarkin is the CEO of the British Beer and Pub Association. She's doing an incredible job. Emma Inch is the chair of the British Guild of Beer Writers. You've got ABI's president. I've never met her myself, but I follow her, Paula Lindenberg. She's running ABI for the UK, so it doesn't get much bigger than that. One of the strongest and most respected women in hospitality is a wonderful woman called Anne Elliott. She actually identified that there's a lack of women in hospitality on boards, so went out there and did something about it with two other fellow female founders and set up an amazing program called Plan B, which I highly recommend. I actually got a fantastic mentor out of it, Robert Cook, who's been so supportive. He's the CEO of TGI's. Then you've got founders like Mel Marriott, who set up Darwin and Wallace. You've got Louisa Zion of Toast. You've got Lucy Wright, Nice Wines, we just had lunch with. Amazing, incredible founders who are all blazing a trail. You know, they do say about women in power that if they're leaning through a trap door, they'll either pull you up through it or they'll shut the door. And I have only ever found women that have pulled me up and pull women up, and I'm trying to pay it forwards and coach as many people as possible. In FMCG, the CEO of Co-op Food is Jo Whitfield, absolutely incredible woman who set up the Grocery Girls, which is, a fantastic networking group for women in grocery that I'm part of. And finally, in Know and Low, there's an amazing woman called Laura Willoughby, who's just unstoppable, who's set up an amazing, amazing organisation called Club Soda for people looking for alcohol-free options. So I haven't seen it, and I really believe you've got to see it to be it. And there are so many women to aspire to out there that have been so helpful. At Lucky Saint, obviously, for us, you know, as a male and female leadership team, you know, we both say we report into the board. So on an organogram, Luke and I are at the top. And I think that helps breed this culture of equality. And then through every level of the business, we have been very mindful in our recruitment to make sure we've got 50-50 male and female. So, you know, it kind of starts at the top, but it runs through everything we do.
So yeah, I mean, at the time of recording, we're kind of just a few days away from emerging from the last stages of lockdowns. Everyone's got fingers crossed. And Luke, you've touched on kind of the impact last year and how the business has kind of have managed and done well, which is great. But looking ahead, kind of what are the plans for the business post-pandemic?
I mean, our big thing, like, we've only literally just started on this draft journey. We think it's going to be, you know, the most significant thing for the category and for our business. We think we've got cans coming, which is very exciting for us, So we do one thing well. So we brew lager, but it's all about having it in all of the right formats. So that's been something that's been that we've worked very hard on to get right. So that's coming this summer.
And of course, Luke, investment from Jam Jar, for those who don't know, is the Three Innocent Founders, their investment fund. Have you used that money for anything specific?
Yeah, so the founders from Jam Jar invested in us at the beginning of this year. Amazing to be working with them. They are very, very good at this stuff, I'd say. So yeah, it's pretty humbling to have them sitting on our board and getting their inputs on important kind of strategic projects. But I think what that investment's done mainly is it's given us the funding to be able to go and grow the team at an accelerated rate. So we were, I think we were 16 people at the beginning of the year. We'll be 30 by the end of next month. They help on kind of three areas for us, because there's the three founders have Adam has a commercial bias, John has a kind of operation and production bias, and then Richard's obviously a hero on brand and marketing. So we work with them on those different areas to get as much as we can. Their learnings from, they did such a phenomenal job at Innocent, obviously. Yeah. It's been like pretty humbling to spend time with them, I'll be honest.
We don't want to stay on the topic for too long, but kind of thinking about COVID, and I guess this is a question for both of you on a slightly more personal note, and I'll ask it in a way of sort of looking back in 10 years' time, how would you reflect on your kind of your own personal experiences throughout the pandemic? Emma, I'll start with you.
Yeah, obviously I joined a business that was on a high, had an amazing January, then we went into lockdown, and actually Luke and I kind of shut ourselves away for a day and looked at the P&L. We slashed 65% of the cost. The team then all, volunteered to take 50% pay cut so we could keep the business going. We only had 3 weeks of cash. And then we came out victorious, and we were the second biggest selling lager on Amazon, only behind a 24 pack of Foster's. So it was an amazing ride. And I'm not going to lie, like, we worked bloody hard for a couple of months. I was getting up at 5 a.m. and doing 2 hours work before my children got up. But I will definitely look back, maybe with rose tinted glasses. We pivoted the business hard. We went, hard into DTC. And a few months later, we were in 1,500 grocery stores. We have a very strong business. We've got an incredible team. I think it obviously made Luke and I bond very, very quickly. And I will probably look back with huge amounts of gratitude.
And how about you, Luke?
It was such an intense period. As Emma said, it was pretty eye-opening when we kind of staring down the barrel of kind of, losing 70% of our business, but equally just so galvanizing. The team and the way that the team worked together, as Emma said, we were thrown as a new working relationship. We were literally 4 weeks in. So that kind of galvanized that incredibly quickly. And I think as it's gone on, and we went through so many phases of, I remember initially we were all team call at the beginning and end of every single day. It was that level of intensity of getting stuff done, repositioning the business, selling through new channels. But then and also just bringing people on the journey, making sure people were okay. What it's done is then I think everyone's found their feet, and the all team calls move from twice a day to once a day to three times a week to once a week. And so, it has all normalized, but out the back of it, we've then done this big kind of values and purpose exercise and articulating that. And that's actually been so much of the values and the kind of foundations of the business have really sort of been built off that. We did it in the trenches together. So I think it's been really, really powerful.
Well, it's that time in the podcast when we talk about advertising and more specifically our favorite TV ads. And I'm going to blow your covers. Okay, guys, are you ready for this? So Luke's dad is probably my biggest hero in advertising. Martin Bose, who was running the agency BMP. Emma, you worked at Ogilvy. So did I. Okay, so we're alumni. So let's start with you, Emma. What is... Oh, you worked on Mattel as well. So you're a Barbie fan, I bet. Yeah?
I love Barbie.
You had to say that. So, but anyway, Emma, what is your favourite TV ad? And as you know, we're on the radio, so try and paint a picture with words as you tell us all about it.
My favourite advert, Mark, is an advert for Carling Black Label. And it involved a squirrel, a red squirrel. That shows how old the advert was. To the Mission Impossible music, getting from one pole, you know, scrabbling up the pole, going along the chain, leaping to another form, and finally, obviously, getting his nuts, as it were. And there are two owls at the end staring straight into the frame, and one of them says,
"I bet he brings Carling Black Label."
That had a massive impression on me when I was younger. But even now, I go running around Bushy Park in the morning. So this morning, I was running around Bushy Park. When I see squirrels, it still makes me smile. I love how cheeky they were. I love the music. I love the deadpan owls at the end. And my two daughters insist on watching this advert all the time now.
Thank you, Emma, for that description. It's always always harder than it sounds to give a good description of the ad. So we're all picturing it, and we'll all be on YouTube straight afterwards. And coming to you, Luke. We know you did a brief stint as a runner at Academy Films, so you also kind of touched the advertising world. But tell us and the listeners, what's your favourite TV ad, and do your best to help us picture it.
Yeah, I actually found it really hard to pick one in the end, having kind of grown up in a family of advertising, and I've got the Smash ads etched in my brain and the R. White's ads. But I did, as you said, I worked as a runner at Academy Productions, which is Jonathan Glazer's production company. And I spent many, many, many hours putting showreels together. And so I've got so many of his commercials that etched in my brain before I then ran them around Soho. But the one I went work for was Guinness's Swim Black, where is this wonderful, like, evocative story of an ex-Olympic swimmer, an ex-Olympic swimmer who every year is set the task of swimming from a buoy out at sea, and as he swims past the buoy, the flag drops and the barman starts pouring a pint of Guinness, and he has to make it. He has to swim as fast as he can all the way to the bar and make it to the bar before the Guinness is settled and finished pouring.
My brother's a hero.
There's so much in 90 seconds of commercial. There's so much storytelling, and there are so many amazing faces as he's swimming along. It cuts to these, like, wonderful different characters of people watching, because the whole town has come out to watch him swim. And then he makes it to the end, and then just this lovely twist at the end before he drinks the Guinness, that actually the starter guarantees that he's never going to not make it in time, because actually he's given him a 10-meter head start.
It takes 119.5 seconds to pour the perfect pint. But the best time is kept when you don't want your watch too tight.
1998. And it was the first ad that AMV, as they were known in those days, made, having just stolen, Emma, the account from us. They just won the business from Ogilvy as well.
It's a really good one.
I think the other sort of lovely thing, actually, that I got out of that ad, that, I mean, there are some incredible Guinness ads, but there's just this moment of, like, utter refreshment that's kind of completely captured in a way that, I don't know, yeah, it really, yeah, I love it.
And not typically associated with Guinness either. You're right, absolutely right. That kind of post kind of something refreshment. Yeah,
yeah.
I completely agree. Well, I'll be on to YouTube again for that one. So, well, brilliant. Look, thank you both so much for doing that. And thank you so much for the chat. It's been brilliant. I'm actually going to Central London this evening, so I'm going to find a Lucky Saint. I have it on draft because you've made me very thirsty. But no, it's been a brilliant chat. Really interesting to listen to you guys. We wish you all the very best. And thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Lovely to see you.
Okay, and bye for now. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Wax Lyrical, the scale-up and change-up marketing podcast from Waxhorn. Please let us know what you think of this episode by rating us, or even better, by writing a short review on Apple Podcasts. We make the podcast in our spare time just for the love of it, and are so grateful to all our guests and to you, the listeners, for making it happen. It would mean a lot to us to hear that you enjoy it. Thank you.